Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning from freezing upstate New York. It's 34 degrees, but don't worry about it. We've got a show for you that is going to absolutely keep everyone on their toes. And let me introduce my guest. I am so excited. The author of A-List is here, and that's right, I read it, and it's fantastic, and we're going to be talking about that on December 11th. And D.P. Lyle is here. Hi, Doug. Good morning. How you doing?
How are you doing, Brian? Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. And we have my favorite lawyer in the whole universe from Texas, and we're going to talk to Larry Thompson, and I can't wait for his new book to come out in March and have another interview. How you doing, Larry?
I'm doing great, and thank you for inviting me to join with all these other great law enforcement doctors and authors.
Yeah, this is going to be fun. And we have one of my favorite detectives in the world, Bruce Coffin, is here. And wait till you see my review later on Beneath the Depths. And boy, that novel was really good. And I got eye strain, which means I read it in one day. Good morning, Bruce. I'm glad you're here.
Good morning, friend. Thank you.
I just want to compliment Bruce. I did this before we got on the air, but I was just looking at what he'd written this morning, and he's written two novels, both of them with a lot of reviews and 4.8 stars on Kindle, and that's very rare you see somebody with that kind of reader reviews, and so just my compliments to you.
Thank you, Larry.
Well, you're going to get my 5 stars later, but they won't let me give you more than 5, will they? But that's okay. And the author, the creator of Crimes and Times, is here. Mike's got this great new show, and I get the reviews on my phone. So they say, "Friend, you got to watch this." And I sit down and I watch it, and I get interrupted, then I get annoyed because the shows are so really interesting, and I'm learning a lot. So the author of Bad Intent is here, and I'm waiting for you to write the next one. Michael Tavin is here. How you doing?
How you doing, friend? And hello to all the guests.
I'm hanging in there, and I'm excited too because my book's got 9 5-star reviews and 1 4-star review. That's okay. That's not bad for a beginner.
That's fantastic.
For a daughter.
That's
fantastic. I'm hoping to get more. The book is about Alzheimer's, and I'm hoping to give, more people buy it that can give a bigger donation. So we're going to talk about how to create a mystery thriller the right way. And since I've read too many on the evidence that's presented, forensic evidence, what type of evidence does the investigator or the police look for before turning the crime over, to the Emmy or anyone else? Now, if you want to bring it into what's happening in Tribeca, what happened last week, or Las Vegas, or even Texas last week, that's fine. But whoever wants to take the first question, what would you look for? You're invited to a scene of a crime like that. What is the first thing that would be the proper protocol? What do you look for first, besides the person that's dead?
Well, Fran, if I may, being from the law enforcement, having handled these mass shootings in the past and still commentating on them fairly often, unfortunately, the question is always, they ask you, what did the police do first? And the first thing is to assess the danger and eliminate the threat. So, again, obviously, even if people are wounded and dying, unfortunately, sometimes caring for them, believe it or not, can't be the first priority, the first responder. They have to make sure that the shooter or shooters have been neutralized. So that's the first thing they have to do. So you'll always hear them say, we think he's the only shooter or someone's on the loose, because they never want to make a mistake of assuming it was one shooter when there might be more than one. Though generally these are lone individuals, generally, but you can't count on that. So the first thing is to neutralize the threat, see if there's any sort of second shooter drop. Sometimes we've seen that with the co-conspirator who may have gotten away, or if these are more terrorist-minded rather than someone who's a troubled individual, though terrorists are troubled individuals. But, do they have a second plan? Do we have to lock down any part of the city? So the first and foremost is the safety and security of everybody. And then they get into bringing in the first responders to treat the wounded, evacuate them, and then, of course, the investigation continues.
But that
and
would
that's,
be really
that's true, and
right.
the first
yeah,
thing, yeah, the mm-hmm. first thing is to protect everybody. The second thing is to, help the injured, and the third thing is to begin to work the scene and preserve the evidence. So if you look at that, it's third down the list in most of these situations like this. So that's why evidence can get lost, contaminated, changed so that it doesn't become useful, and it becomes a very difficult problem when it comes to prosecuting the crime. And I'm sure Larry can tell you that it's it's like data in a computer. Bad data is worse than no data. bad evidence is worse than no evidence, and because it can lead you down the wrong path sometimes.
Well, also,
what happens when the which is better, if the guy is killed or if the guy is not killed? Which is better? I mean, in the last three, two they were killed, and the last one in Tribeca, he's alive.
Well, from a law enforcement point of view, you want to talk to the guy who did the shooting if you can, because you know, motive means opportunity, connections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he may not he may try not to talk, but they got methods of, you know, tricking these guys and finding information.
Yeah.
If the person's dead, you know, well, you're dead in the water. You're not going to get any information from him. Really, you're going to have to do it the old-fashioned way by checking his background and talking to friends and family and things like that. But if he's alive and can communicate, well, that's another avenue of inquiry right there.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to point out, Fran, that you know, after, even when someone is killed in these shootings, even if there's not a second shooter they know of, they still investigate this as if the case is going to go to trial. Because you never know. So people think, oh, how much more do you need to do? He's dead. That's really, it just gets that much harder, as the other speaker just pointed out, without that information, because they have to secure all the evidence, make sure they understand, because you never know if something else is going to be detected. Someone else was a co-conspirator or facilitator. So this will be investigated as if the person is going to trial, even if he's dead.
I'm just going to comment. You're talking about these three most recent mass shootings we've had. We have the one in Texas, who the killer was killed. The guy in Las Vegas was killed, and then you have the one in Tribeca, who apparently is still alive. But certainly, I agree with Doug that if you're dealing with, you'd much rather have somebody alive rather than having to go back and reconstruct. I think they've done a pretty good job of figuring out. This guy in Texas was mentally ill and never should have been allowed to buy a gun. But the guy in Las Vegas, you know, I think they've searched everything they can, and they can't figure out why in the world he did what he did. And so it's a lot better if he lived so somebody could talk to him.
That's scary, because I still think that the girlfriend must do something. I can't believe that the girlfriend didn't know anything, that the hotel didn't know anything. It's so weird.
Well, I think the girlfriend had to know something. I mean, she didn't just take off to the Philippines without knowing something was coming down.
I agree with you.
I have this question for Bruce or Michael on this. And since we got you guys here, how was it the guy in Las Vegas could buy 40 or so guns over the course of 1 year without somebody picking up in the system, hey, this guy's buying a lot of guns, let's check him out? Is there no way to track that?
It's because we, in this country right now, we don't want to control that in any sense. There's no will to do that. So, yeah, you know, I was out with a friend of mine, a retired law enforcement guy, who was complaining about these mass shooters and how they accumulate all these weapons and all this ammunition. And I'm not joking. This is what we were doing at the moment. I was with him shopping because he was stacking up on his ammunition to go hunting. And I said, well, would you want someone checking you now? He goes, no, why would they check me? I said, there's my point, because we have nothing in place to – I mean, we could check how much Sudafed you have, but we don't check on how many weapons or how much ammunition you have. And to me, this is part of that logical gun control that we have. I don't know why anybody would resist, you know, having some controls on just this point on the accumulation of weapons and weapons of tools of mass murder and high-capacity magazines and rounds, thousands of rounds of ammo. We may not stop every mass shooting, but we can certainly reduce them from happening and reduce the impact if and when they happen. But to answer your question, is because we have no controls over that.
So there's no way that anybody can look and see, okay, this guy in Las Vegas, he's up to 20 guns, now he's up to 25. Somebody needs to be watching him. There's no way to do that.
You know, there's a database that the FBI maintains when people get their background check for weapons. But that's just for that. You know, it's prohibited for law enforcement. Hey, I want to see how many guns Michael has. Let's go back and see how many times he's been checked or someone's done a background check on. That's prohibited, again, because everyone's so afraid of, you know, this government control of owning the weapons.
But what happens when the background check shows that he's clear, but it's really not that person, and he uses a fake, a fake social security number, or he's got a fake information, and he uses a different name? Can they tell that that's not real, that maybe he's using an alias? Because I'm reading a book like now called Death by Drowning, and the character in the book is, you know, trying to hide the fact who he was. Can that happen?
Sure.
Yeah, it could happen. Sure, it could happen, yeah.
Sure. And people buy guns person to person. You know, it doesn't always go through a registered dealer.
Exactly.
You know, there's sites that you can go buy guns from anybody. You can buy them on the street. You know, that's mm-hmm. the problem. You know,
yeah.
every regulation you put in, there's a way around it.
God.
Every weekend in Texas, there are gun shows all over the state, and they're not very well controlled or regulated.
No.
Dealer is not going to really be, you know, you give him some ID unless he has some incredible training and a sharp eye. If it's halfway decent phone ID, he's not going to know, and nor is he going to really take much time to determine.
Right. Exactly.
Well, it's not in his interest to do that, you know, unfortunately.
Exactly.
That is scary. So when you finally realized that you got the police, whatever, what type of questions would you ask the witnesses? And after you process the, you know, when you realize what's happening and everybody's secure and safe, how do you know who to ask questions of? And how do you know what they're answering you is credible, that they're not lying?
Well, that's one of the problems when something happens. And let's just go back to a regular murder scene, you know, rather than a mass shooting. So you're called mm-hmm. because somebody heard gunshots at the next door neighbor's house, and they go in there and they find somebody dead.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's people who are around, standing out, out in the yard, the neighbors, everybody's been awakened, you know, because of all the activity. Well, how do you know who's the suspect and who's a witness, and how do you know who's just an innocent
mm-hmm.
bystander? Sometimes
yeah.
that's very difficult. So you want to get enough manpower there. You separate people. You don't let them collude with one another. And you start in asking them questions one at a time. You know, why are you here? Where do you live? What's your relationship to this? You know, of course, the killer can lie about all this, but
mm-hmm.
at least they got somebody they're talking to. So you separate, you interrogate. It's as simple as that. And then,
mm-hmm.
Like I said in the beginning, you don't know if the person standing around out there in the yard is the one that actually did it, or it's just the next door neighbor who was awakened. And you got to make that determination.
We have to be kind of observant and perceptive, I imagine. And after
sure.
doing it for so many years, I would. DB, how would you handle that? I mean, you're presenting the forensics. You're really good at that.
Well, I mean, you separate them and talk to them, like I said. You also preserve the scene. You go through the steps we talked about earlier about make sure there's not an active shooter, make sure everybody's safe,
mm-hmm.
Make sure that, you know, the person inside is, like, really dead, you know, and not just injured and looks dead. Because that
mm-hmm.
changes things. But let's say the person's dead and it's obvious and the shooter, whoever it is gone. Well, now the next thing you do is you do crowd control. You control the scene, you separate
mm-hmm.
any potential witnesses, and you start working the scene and working the witnesses, and that requires manpower. You know, in a small jurisdiction, you got, you know, Andy and Barney doing it. You know, in a place like New
yeah.
York or Miami or Chicago, you may have 50 people show up there by the time it's all said and done. It just depends. And each one of those will have a different scenario. And it's great stuff for fiction writers because, you know, I always
yeah.
tell my stories in small towns because I don't want to deal with a lot of this BS that I write about. You know?
small towns in Alabama, by the way.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, well, A-List is really good, but you bring it over to Las Vegas and movies, and I'm not going to say more. And that was really good. It kept me going. I love the main character. He had me hysterical laughing, so which is great. I really liked it. So I'm excited about that one coming out. So when the police realize that the murder, like this guy in Tribeca, when the police realize that this is a murder related to something that he might be linked to, like terrorist attack or organized crime, is that particular case handled differently if you were going to write it up or talk about it or handle it? How is it? Does that bring the FBI in faster?
Yeah, it does. Most of the cases, that have terrorism involved or have a criminal network that might extend beyond state lines. The FBI is involved, and it's not what you see on television. The FBI just show up and start ordering the cops around. And they don't have this really tense standoff as to who's in charge. You know, though I did use that scene in Bad Intent. You know, you got to play it up, but you know, you got to play to the audience. But you know, for a long time, we've been working well. Even before 9/11, the big cities like New York had a joint terrorist task force with NYPD, an organized crime task force with NYPD, a bank robbery task force. So this is not a new concept. You know, after 9/11, you know, the president made a proclamation that the FBI is the lead agency in terrorism. You know, of course, that applies only to the federal agencies. You can't dictate to local law enforcement. But we've never had a problem. They always defer, as you see on television. As soon as they feel that there's been a mass shooting that might be involved in terrorism, they defer to the FBI. The FBI takes over, you know, speaking and leading the investigation. It doesn't mean anyone's been knocked out. It's just a matter of the FBI's got the resources, has the expertise, has the jurisdiction to do that. But the PD stays involved. There's still homicides. And most likely, on these cases, these mass shooters, even if they've been, you know, motivated by some terrorist online scene, ISIS or whomever, the crimes themselves are very well likely going to be prosecuted on the state level for homicide.
Exactly.
Because the international terrorism statute won't play in, and there is no domestic terrorism statute. You know, I'm sure our prosecutor could talk about that. There are certain crimes, you know, such as weapons of mass destruction, but if you just go in there with handguns or weapons, most likely you're not going to have a federal charge. You're going to have a state crime. So we'll work together, but very closely together because of that reason.
They're not going to make a deal with this guy if he gives up anybody else. They wouldn't say, you know, you were going to give you a lesser sentence or something like that, because after what he did, forget it. He killed so many people in Tribeca. They're not going to say to him, if you give us, cooperate with us, they're going to, you know, give you a lesser sentence. That would be horrible. Would they do that?
Sure.
That wasn't bothering me all week.
Of course
they
would. You know, it depends upon how far up the food chain things go. You know, there have been cases with the mafia where you have a guy who's a contract killer, and he may have killed 20 people for the boss. You know, the capo de tutti capos, and he may. But when they catch him, like Tony the Bull, and they got him right, and he says, okay, I'll tell you everything I know. You know, just don't do this. So they lessen his sentence, maybe even take him out and put him in witness protection, change everything.
Oh, God.
Whatever it takes, because what they want to do is get up the food chain and get to the people who are making the decisions. Yes or no, they may do it, they may not do it. It depends on the cost and the benefit.
Would that come out to the public that they did that? Would just stay hidden? Whatever?
That's public record. That's public information.
Yeah. Sure.
Oh, my God. I would hate to think that this guy was walking around someplace else and he's going to kill more people someplace else. That would be horrible.
Well, Fran, let's not take it to extremes on that, because these shooters most likely, unlike, you know, Sammy the Bull, you know, they're really not going to have higher ups in these instances to give up. You know, maybe there's a network there. And if they negotiate something, they would probably negotiate, you know, taking the death penalty off the table.
Yeah.
Right.
They're not going to negotiate, you know, a two-year sentence and then you walk.
Exactly.
You know, that's not going to
happen.
So, you know, we have to put it in context of what would realistically happen, because, you know, they have to answer to the public as well. And you're just not going to tell families of, you know, people who have been killed innocently, oh, we're going to let this guy walk just for some more information. So I wouldn't be too concerned with that happening, you know, to a point of being, you know, injustice.
So, Mike, if we have, or Bruce, anybody, that we have this bike path. Should there have been cars on this bike path or any bike path or anything like that? Should that have been – they rope off up here on Bronx River Parkway. They shut off the parkway to cars and vehicles in the summertime. So why was there – are cars allowed on bike paths like that? Or should not – they should not – the truck shouldn't have been there. Or he just went there because he didn't care?
Your latter statement. He went there just to do what he did.
Yeah. And it's hard to totally protect people from that. I mean, if that's somebody's motive, unless the area around it has been built up in such a way that it actually prevents that from happening, like concrete barricades or whatever, it's impossible to stop that from happening.
Exactly.
It's like somebody that a killer that leaves the street and goes up on the sidewalk and starts running down people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not supposed to be there, but it happens.
Right.
That's what
and it's really hard to protect
London.
Yourself against someone who's not afraid to die.
Right.
You know, most
people
who commit crimes want to get away with it. They want to live through it. But if you've got a group that they don't really care whether they live or die. And in fact, some of them, even death is the way. I mean, that's what they're looking for. That's very hard to defend yourself against. I mean, it's almost impossible, you know. They're not looking for an escape route. They're not planning an escape route. They're not trying to cover their tracks. They're not trying to create a scenario where they disappear. They're just going to go do the job, and then whatever happens, okay, fine.
I know, and I've read too many books like that, and it's scary because sometimes the evidence. So, Larry, if you were going to put this in context for if somebody was going to write this up and bring these people to court, what kind of documents and discovery, what would they need in order to not get it kicked out of court? Because like I said, I've read so many books that some of them, like, Bruce, I read your book, and John Byron is very methodical. And even though his Leroy wanted to scream at him and yell at him, I was so glad that he screamed back and said, you know, like, doesn't matter, I'm going to do it my way, even if he got in trouble, no matter what. I was, like, so impressed. I go, yeah, somebody to actually care about what happened. And just when he thought he knew who did it, he didn't know who did it. I won't tell you if I figured it out. I'm really good. My deductive reasoning was working. But I said, oh, my God, no one's going to get this. So what type of evidence would you need? Would you write, or what type of evidence are they going to need so that it doesn't get thrown out of court? So you're sure that this guy's going to go down for something?
Yeah, let's start with a couple of basic concepts. First of all, is that the burden of proof in a civil trial? Mm-hmm. It's preponderance of the evidence, which is something more likely true than not true, and that's really all it is. Very, very low burden. Criminal, you get beyond a reasonable doubt. That's a high burden. That means that the kinds of things we're talking about now, about making sure that people at the crime scene are not harmed any more themselves. You're every time you do that, you're risking somehow contaminating the crime scene. Every little bit of contamination can potentially blow up into something that would create that reasonable doubt in a jury's mind, but the things that you're looking for, and the things that we all know these days, is that, and I've done it. I'm a civil trial lawyer. I'm not a criminal trial lawyer, but I've tried tons of cases, and in the past 15 years or so, with all of the CSIs and crime shows and so forth on television, juries, I guarantee you, watch those shows. And they want you to dot every I and cross every T. They want to see the DNA evidence. They want to see everything down to the last detail. Otherwise, they'll say, well, wait a minute, you didn't prove it because I saw this CSI show and I saw what they did, or NCIS, or whatever you want to talk about. So the things that you normally would think about, obviously, are photos, video, the weapon itself, fingerprints. DNA has become so big these days. In Houston, we have had a major problem with our crime lab and contaminating DNA, and we have had literally hundreds of cases thrown out over a several-year period because, frankly, our crime lab was incompetent. Finally, the state took it over, and so they've been doing a better job, but a lot of criminals went free because the DNA evidence was not good. And then you can look at tire marks, tires. Obviously, eyewitnesses are important. Eyewitnesses, of course, can disagree with one another, and that's always a problem. I was representing a trucking company years ago, the truck driver crossed a railroad track and it did not have a crossbar, but it had blinking red lights, and the truck was hit by a train, and the engineer in the train was killed, strangely enough. But there were 10 eyewitnesses, and would you believe it, that out of the 10 eyewitnesses, 5 of them said those red lights were on and flashing, and 5 of them said they were not.
That's typical.
Yeah, that's right. So you get people looking at any kind of a fender bender in the middle of an intersection, who ran the red light, what happened at the crime scene. Eyewitnesses are important, but you get a lot of eyewitnesses. Every one of them's going to it's a little bit like the blind man and the elephant. Everybody sees it, feels a little bit different part of the elephant and describes it differently. So all of that has to come together. But at the end of the day, what you're looking to establish is that you have come up with sufficient evidence, depending on what it is and what the crime is about, that you can take it to the prosecutor and say, here, you have enough evidence that you can establish this beyond a reasonable doubt. And then that prosecutor has
to
sit down.
Do they do any research? Does the prosecutor do any research on his or her own? Do they check anything out? Do they act, or do they give it to their clerks or anybody else to work on? Or do they actually work on it, or do they wait till it's all processed and done?
I think varies from... Go ahead.
That's one of the things that, you know, they talk about the level playing field of between prosecutors and defense attorneys. Prosecutors have the whole government. You know, they have the police, they have the crime lab, they have the medical examiner, they have all these people collecting evidence on, quote, their side of the fence. In other words, they're looking for evidence that can lead to a prosecution for who committed the crime. The defense, on the other hand, doesn't have those resources. But that's why the law requires that the prosecution turn over the evidence. Now, do they always? Of course not.
No.
You know, they try to drag their feet and delay things and, you know, twist the law. And I'm sure Larry can tell you more about that. But because they don't want the defense to get this evidence until late in the day, so to speak, so they don't know how to defend against it. So they'll drag their feet on that. But, yes, all of the death investigation and criminal investigation network is on the side of the law. It's the police, the crime lab, the medical examiner, and the prosecutors have total access to that.
I think
it varies. Maybe Bruce or Michael can comment about this, but I think it varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction as to whether the district attorney will actually go out and have somebody in his or her office following up on what the officers have done or not. Some VA's offices will have their own investigators. Some will not.
In the state of Maine, it's the Attorney General's office that's actually charged with prosecuting homicide cases. And so they don't have their own investigators to go follow up on murder cases. They use the detectives from the agency that's investigating to follow up. So if I submit evidence or certain things to the attorney general who's going to be prosecuting the case, and they want more, say, to shore up a search warrant or whatever it is, that's incumbent upon the detective investigating to go back out and get that information.
Do they actually like they say on television? Do they investigate the police officers when they want to question someone and they don't want to come in? Is it all that true, or do they actually, you know, ask them to come in nicely, or do they have to get tough with them?
Fran, there's no such thing as saying, we're bringing you down for questioning. That's an arrest. You could ask them to come, but you can't force them to come unless you got them placed on the arrest. No, I'm holding you until you confess or whatever. It's great for television, but that's not how it works. Unless you're under arrest, we're not bringing you down. And just to answer the other question, here where I am in Kansas City, I'm working, Fran, I think you've seen it, some wrongful conviction cases or unfair conviction cases. Not only the DAs have their own investigators, so I do the wrap-up, you know, stuff that they may want to just track down a witness, you know, once the case has been fully investigated, do some wrap-up, not really the investigation itself. But the defense, you know, the appointed defense attorney also has access to an investigator. Unfortunately, the quality of that work is pretty poor, and I have two cases here where they just did absolutely nothing. And a lot of exculpatory evidence, which I think would have been found, hasn't been found, and trying to recreate that 20 years later is almost impossible.
That's amazing. And these people, the police have a lot. Do they have anybody really? So I read Bruce's book thoroughly, and I read all of your books thoroughly. Do they have people that actually can hack into files that nobody else could get? And do these criminals actually have access to that, too, if they really wanted it, to find out what's happening?
I can tell you they're not hacking into the FBI.
Let me say one
more.
They're not
hacking into the FBI.
Just think about Equifax. I mean, I don't think there's any computer system around that is fail-safe anymore.
No.
No, but again, like you see these FBI agents come home and they sign in online at the house, and then you know the girlfriend, the boyfriend, you know, watches the password. That at least when I left the FBI, I don't think it's changed. That doesn't exist. Right? There is no remote access to the FBI, you know, intranet. It's a closed system, so you cannot hack into that. I mean, unless you can figure out where the cables are buried somewhere and tap that. You know, but realistically, no, you cannot just sit at home and tap into the FBI, the CIA database, you know, from the outside. That's just fiction.
That says, I know, and when you're watching CSI, my husband's addicted to it, TB. He can't stop watching it. I mean, how true to life is something like that? What happens on CSI or Criminal Minds or something like that? I mean, my brother's addicted to it. My nephew's, my husband thinks this is the greatest program on television. And I'm saying, like, they always manage to get it, and sometimes they don't. How true to life is that? I mean.
Well, having consulted on a couple of their shows.
That's what I said. I know. That's
It's not that they're wrong. The CSI clones and the things out there, they talk about cutting edge stuff a lot, and it's not that couldn't happen and doesn't happen and doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. Most of what they do does exist, but you have to understand that 99.9% of crimes are not going to involve that. It's too sophisticated. Mm-hmm. It's too uncommon. It's too rare. It's too cool for school. It's just not going to happen. You know, you mentioned earlier about DNA. DNA is involved in, 1-3% of cases? The rest of them, you know, the spouse did it. You know, you don't need DNA. You know, cops do good work, and detectives do good work, and they solve most cases by talking to people and by gathering the evidence in the old-fashioned way, and DNA is rarely used in cases if you take all types of cases. But CSI makes the uncommon look common and commonplace, and Larry mentioned earlier about the CSI effect. That's just fed into that. Juries show up and they say, well, where's the DNA and where's the hair and fiber and where's this and where's that and da da da. Well, that's got nothing to do with this case. You know, that's why we don't have it. Well, you must be incompetent if you don't have it. That's the problem right there.
Right. That's exactly right. I'd like for our two law enforcement panelists to discuss this. In recent years, it seems that cameras are everywhere. Security cameras, street cameras, everything else. How has that changed how law enforcement is investigating crimes these days?
Oh, that's an easy one. You know, I got hit with that question back during the Boston Marathon bombings, because cameras figured so important to that. You know, and the question being, you know, one, is this an invasion of our privacy? The answer is no, at least not under our laws, you know, and our mores. When you're out in public, you're out in public. Camera's not watching you, it's watching the area. And everyone just has to accept the fact that this is just how life is now. But they have become invaluable in the sense that you can just track movements where people were, pick them up somewhere else, see where they went, see who they met with, maybe what they did beforehand. They become invaluable. That's one of the first things they do, even on missing person cases. They'll go back and say, all right, which way was the car driving? Let's find cameras, not just, traffic cams. Mm-hmm. People's cameras, you know, they're on the doorbell. They pass a house. They pass an ATM. You know, we use those without hesitation. But what I fear also is what we got to, the CSI effect. I wonder if we're going to get to the point where the jury says, well, where's the videotape? And, you know, if there's not a videotape, you know, it didn't happen. I can kind of see that happening now. But they become invaluable, and it's a standard investigative measure now to start checking anywhere something might have been picked up on video.
So what happens with these hotels? Like, people walk into hotels, they walk into airports, and supposedly anybody could walk in anywhere. And after what happened in Las Vegas, and if you're going to write something like that, shouldn't there be more protection in a hotel? I mean, anybody could walk into the Grand Hyatt, and anybody could walk into any hotel, any airport. So how do you protect people in public places from this happening?
Well, I suspect the Las Vegas mass murderer, he was probably caught on cameras going back and forth for a week.
Yeah.
But he was just carrying luggage, and nobody really paid any attention to him.
And those cases didn't look like gun cases? Nobody realized that there was gun cases? Or did he put it in regular luggage?
I'm sure he just had them in some kind of luggage as he was just pulling along behind him.
Sure. I mean, go to any of those hotels. I've stayed at the Mandalay Bay many times over there. And, it's like all the other hotels there. You go check in, there's 20 people waiting to check in, and they all got big rolling suitcases. This guy wouldn't have stood out. It's easy after the fact. Before the fact, it's like he just looked like somebody else. It's easy to be a Monday morning quarterback.
The question Fran and I were discussing before the rest of you guys got on and we got started here was he able in the Mandalay Bay to tell housekeeping, I don't want my room clean for the next week, don't let anybody come in?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
And that's allowed?
Yeah, I don't know that's happened, though. I had no information that he did that.
Right.
Well, I don't know whether he did or not. I'm just thinking if he had all these weapons and ammunition in there, you'd think some maid would have reported it.
Well, even so, he probably wouldn't have left it alone, out, probably left in a suitcase in the closet. And as we know, at most of the reputable hotels, when they go in there, they leave the door open while they're cleaning. For obvious reasons. And it cleaned, they're supposed to get in and get out. They're not supposed to be snooping around in closets and luggage. So, with a little precaution, if it's a respectable hotel, I imagine pretty easy to keep something in there and not get spotted.
They had a case here in Orange County.
They had a case here in Orange County
where a guy lived in a hotel for a year, and he had his girlfriend there in the bathtub on ice. She was dead on ice all this time. And he said, I don't need room service. Don't come into my room. And the hotel said, fine, that's your privacy. Well, he would every day bring in more bags of ice. it was shocking and amazing, but he got away with
it
for a long time. Huh?
Nobody smelled it. Nobody realized he was there. Nobody suspected.
He kept her frozen on ice.
Frozen on ice. Isn't that lovely? This way he kept her around in case he had nothing better to. Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's scary. So that is scary. So when you watch a murder on television and they make all these diagrams, because this is great for mystery writers. And like I said, I've read too many. And a lot of them are really off base. I mean, there was one mystery book that I read that was the first time in all the years that I said to the author, I'm not reviewing your book because you have no idea what you're talking about. The chief of police refused to do the case, so he asked a retired investigator to review it, and he had his wife in the grave, in this ditch or whatever, handing him the bones of the dead body. I was like, I don't think so. And yeah. Seriously, and I said to the person that I review for, I said, there's no way that I'm going to even finish. I don't even care who did it, because this is probably one of the most ridiculous books I've ever read. So what is the purpose of drawing the diagrams and sketches of the body? Does that help as far as location? And if they have a suspect, do people look for somebody else, or do the police just say, okay, that's the one that it is, I'm not going any further?
Well, Fran, in terms of the diagram, you have to be able to recreate the crime scene.
Yeah.
And that goes then to the credibility and the veracity of the evidence. You're looking at trajectory of bullets. You're looking at, how far someone could have fled, how close someone was to someone else. If they shot somebody, based on the wound, based on the penetration to the body, if someone grabbed the weapon, is their story credible based on where they say they were? So, yes, you need to recreate that for credibility. Now, on the other case, what you asked about, the police, just tend to focus in on one person. No, that is an issue. Of course, if you have a logical suspect, you follow the evidence, right? You follow it. And when I give my classes on investigations, for non-law enforcement, I talk about, getting the blinders effect and, how that can kind of focus in on something. And you don't let go of it, and all these cognitive biases. And I've seen that in the cases I'm working now, where despite evidence to the contrary, the investigator, the detective, latched onto who he believed was guilty and wouldn't let go of that, irrespective of any evidence to the contrary. So does it happen? Yes. Should it happen? No. Because if you know what you're doing and you're confident, you should know that you're capable of making mistakes. You're capable of all these biases that make you unwilling to think that maybe you went down the wrong path. And you have to, retool your investigation. So it does happen, but it shouldn't happen. But it's dangerous when it happens because, and I think a prosecutor could get to this as well, we all have this, this tunnel vision that sets in. We're right, you know, where the police, where the prosecutors, we have all these tools and expertise. We're not wrong. We didn't make a mistake. And it does result in wrongful convictions.
Well, they're not going to come out and just say that, actually. But whatever happens when you have... You have evidence.
Fran, this is very much like the practice of medicine. I mean, we make, someone comes in with a symptom and we make a differential diagnosis. So we may have a list of five things that this could be. Now, we kind of know from Jump Street which one it is. But if you ignore the other four, you do it at your own peril and at the patient's peril because things happen. They got chest pain. Okay, it's probably a heart attack, but it could be a dissecting aneurysm. It could be pericarditis. It could be arthritis in the joints of the ribs, or they could have a knife in their back. So you might want to turn the patient over and look at their back. It's like a standing joke in medicine. But the point is you have to consider all the possibilities. Even if your nose tells you, I know what this is, I've seen it before, there's no doubt in my mind, but let's keep
it
open.
So why don't doctors do that?
And that's a great analogy. That was a great analogy. Yeah.
And that's it. That's what you have to do in criminal investigation. You have to keep your eyes open to other possibilities while you're following the path that the evidence is taking you. Make sure you're reading all the symptoms and signs correctly. That's all.
You know, how many people actually do that? And how many doctors really do that? And why don't you come here and be my husband's cardiologist? Seriously.
I think most do, to tell you the truth, or at least they used to. They're training doctors a lot more poorly now than they used to, but that's another issue.
That's very true, because they really don't care as much as they used to.
I think most doctors do it.
Yes.
Start off with a fairly broad differential and then narrow it down.
It's
and they're
part
not
of medical training.
They're not always going to be 100% right. But they're going to make the best diagnosis they can, and that's kind
of
the same thing as with when the cops start narrowing down their focus. They're going to start with the broad picture, and then narrow it down to eventually, hopefully, the right suspect who gets charged with crime. Everybody's human, and we can all get tunnel vision. And sometimes we lose sight of other things because we're convinced that one person is probably the one that did it, and so you set up trying to prove that person did it.
Yeah.
You know, one of the
ways
before to avoid
Before I forget, because I don't want to forget, Tuesday, Gerard de Moreni is going to be here with his new book, Kristen Arrow's novel, New Detroit. And on the 16th, my educator is coming out. The Mean by John Long. It's absolutely about high school, and you guys would love this. It's about a high school assistant principal that actually deals with gangs, and there's a terrorist attack in the school, and the book is done so well that I couldn't put it down. It's 800 pages, and it took me 2 hours to read it, seriously.
Wow.
So the author of The Mean will be here, and it's really true to life, and it could really happen. And as an educator that has seen just about everything, including guns and knives and stuff. And as the dean, I got the fun of taking them away and live to talk about it. Yeah. On the 21st, I have a show at 11 o'clock, A Snifter of Death. Think about having a nice drink. Be careful. And on the 27th, Down to No Good, which is the author wrote about a dead body that comes back to life, and gets back to where he's dead, and then somebody brings him back to life, and I won't even get into the rest of that. And, of course, my favorite person in the whole universe that invites me to the Thriller Fest every year, John Land, will be here on the 6th. And we're going to talk about Strong to the Bone, and it's Caitlin Strong at the best. And let's not forget D.P. Lyle on the 11th. We're going to talk about A-List. The book is right in front of me. My cousin tried to take it, and I grabbed it out of her hand. She can't have it. And, seriously. And Mike is going to be here. We're going to talk more about keeping people safe, bullying in school, which is something I know a lot about as an educator, and more. And I just booked a show with Alan Topol for April 23rd. Seriously. So if anybody's got anything coming out, just let me know before I have two in January, and Dennis Palumbo's Head Wounds, you want to read it. Seriously, it's one of the best. So you have evidence collection, and DP writes about this, and consultant, and everybody does. You have evidence collection and package and everything. Does it ever get stolen and disappear?
Sure. And it gets altered and changed and mishandled. And remember, evidence is whatever is essential to understand what happened in the crime. And it can be anything. It can be a chewing gum wrapper. It can be a bullet that's taken out of a dead person. It can be anywhere in between. And there's psychological evidence, and there's physical evidence, and biological evidence, and all that stuff. But number one, if the evidence is useful, first of all, it has to be present. Second of all, it has to be found. Third of all, it has to be gathered. Fourth, it has to be handled properly. Fifth, it has to be analyzed properly. And sixth, it has to be understood. And there's a breakdown every step of the way there that can happen and potentially make good evidence bad. There's nothing worse than good evidence going bad.
You know, Fran, a few weeks ago on my show, we discussed the Amanda Knox case and had on an author who, you know, talked about why she felt Amanda Knox was guilty. And in the following case, I had another FBI agent, colleague of mine on, and we talked about the case a little bit. And one of the decisions from the Italian Supreme Court that reversed the conviction had to do with the poor handling of evidence.
Right.
And what they wrote was such a rebuke of the police handling. I said, you know, if I got a report like that about one of my agents in the FBI, that a case was thrown out because of that kind of handling of evidence, that would have been hell to pay for that you know, irresponsibility. How you handle the evidence, other than just, you know, chain, people always say chain of custody, that's just part of it. You know, we talked about just before, contamination, you know, cross-contamination, packaging. And then when it gets to the evidence room, you know, it has to be kept there very securely. And I have some friends, former police officers, who now just a consulting, go out there and help police departments look at the way they manage their evidence room, because one of the questions is, and I think it's even in one of my novels, is who is normally in charge of the evidence room? Some tired, burnt-out cop,
right,
you know, who just doesn't want to be there anymore and just doesn't care. You know, the evidence is like, let's give him the evidence room. You know, we give him like the lowest, you know, we want to give him the lowest level of responsibility, so we say the evidence room, but if you think about how responsibility really goes around that, it sort of contradicts itself. So, and look, back in 2015, there's a report about the FBI's DNA analysis and found that they were just coming up with conclusions that were not backed up by the science, but more of a conclusion they wanted to find. And we have got one of the most respected labs in the world in the FBI. Now, that was a major hit. And again, as we discussed, you know, with the defense not having access, though they can sometimes get it and do their own analysis, it's very dangerous if we think that there's any corruption, you know, in the analysis of evidence, because there's very little, you know, way to come back at that. Who would have thunk, you know, that the FBI was not working legitimate science in their analysis of DNA?
Yeah.
This is scary. So you have the chain of custody, you have all this evidence and stuff, and now you have this guy in Tribeca. So how are they going to convict him without you know, having to worry that he's going to get off or get a deal or something? Maybe they'll take the death penalty off, but if they do anything else, that would be crazy. And
well,
how
they
are they going to find out?
They don't need DNA and all that for him.
No, they don't. There's eyewitnesses, there's ballistics. It's probably caught on tape, as we discussed. He's done.
Yeah. And the person that killed him?
Probably not anybody higher up, although it would be interesting to find. They said he was probably, quote, radicalized after he came to the United States. It would certainly be interesting to get into his mind and try to figure out how that came about to the point that he was willing to kill and then be willing to die for what he believed.
That is scary. And this guy in Texas that was killed, is it the bystander, the resident that lived there that killed him, or doesn't it matter at this point?
Well, that according to what I've been reading, this was just a local resident who ran into a house and got a similar AK-15, I think, and chased after the guy. And actually, he's an older man. It looks to be in his 60s, but they said he was a dead-eye shooter, and he shot the suspect three times. But then it appeared that when they got to the suspect in his pickup truck, it looked like he had then taken his own pistol and finished himself off at that point. But it's an interesting dichotomy between the pro-gun people and the anti-gun people, because had the Obviously, the people would say, well, why should you have this AK-15 and all these rounds? But on the other hand, the pro-gun people are saying, well, but if it hadn't been for the other guy, he might have gotten away. Who knows? We don't know. But
let me jump in on that, because being in law enforcement, I'm neither pro-gun nor anti-gun. I mean, I've carried a weapon most of my adult life. I take my boys shooting once in a while, but I'm not a gun enthusiast. And I'm not a great believer in everybody having weapons and no control of the weapons. But to put this in perspective, the gentleman who, the bystander, the citizen, legally owned that weapon, and he would have legally owned that weapon even in the discussion of the logical and sensible gun control, that at least I discussed it with the people I know who share my views. He would have legally owned it. And also, it was very brave what he did, but there's no indication that this guy was going to do anything more after that. If we look at statistics of these mass shooters, they shoot at their target, and that target would be certain people, or it could be certain people associated with a location, such as a school, the church. And after that, when they leave, rarely have we seen them go anywhere else. They generally either go into hiding and wait for the police to shoot them, or they shoot themselves, as often happens. Even if we look back at San Bernardino, they were out for a couple of hours after the shooting. I know there was a question, oh, they would have come back. There was no indication they were going to do anything else. They had all those hours that they were free. They had tons of ammunition and weapons with them. They could have done more. So I don't think he stopped anything else. And also, you know, the concept, he chased this guy at 95 miles an hour with a loaded weapon in his car. I got to tell you, I don't think that was a great idea. You know, if you ran over my family, I don't care who you were chasing, all right, because you decided to go 95 miles an hour. You know, a little bit, we got to, you know, take this with a little bit, you know, of sense here. Nice that he had the covers to stop the guy and shoot him. Nothing wrong with that. But he hit him once in the leg, once in the torso, and then the guy went and committed suicide. But I don't think he stopped anything. I don't think there's anything wrong with what he did. And the guy would legally have the weapon. So I don't think this should change the gun debate in any respect.
Oh, my gosh. That's scary. So from all of your experiences, let me, because we have about five minutes, with this guy, they're not going to give him bail. They're not even going to think to let him out on bail, this one in here. Or would they? They're not going to allow him to have bail. The one in New York. They're not going to give him any. He's not going to have any chance to get out. No.
And well, of course not.
No. I don't see that happening.
I would hope that wouldn't happen, but then you never know what could happen at all, right?
It's true,
seriously.
But that would be insanity.
Well, that I know, but what type of a lawyer? Did I have to ask this question? It's just coming to me as I'm thinking. What type of lawyer would take this case?
Probably.
Who's going to want that? Who's going to want to take that case?
Realistically, it'll end up being a public defender.
Right.
Our court system does require that every criminal have a lawyer, unless the criminal just says I will take on my own defense. But I can't imagine some high-powered lawyer stepping out from his TV studio and say, I'll defend this guy. So it's most likely a local public defender who run the gamut from some of them are very good and some of them are really borderline incompetent. So you just don't know who's going to end up with him.
Well, it's like a losing battle no matter what, except if he gets the death penalty taken off the table, then he will have done something maybe to help this guy, but I don't think so. So why on the news are they saying, because I listen to I-24, the BBC station, why are they saying that this guy is cooperating with them? What is he telling them, if anything?
A lot.
He's just telling them whatever about himself, about how he planned this out, you know, what videos he was watching, things like that.
And maybe connections with other people or groups or whatever, you know, you don't know. You know, whatever he knows is whatever, you know, that may be part of the deal, and they may be working a deal with him, saying, you know, we'll take the needle out of the picture if you start helping us, you know, find out how this happened and who your contacts and your associates are. You know, again, as we talked about that earlier, you got to weigh the pluses and the minuses. There's good and there's bad with these bargains, but, you know, what's the cost-benefit ratio?
Well, he's been here since 2010, I read,
yeah.
And then he lived in New Jersey, and he has a family, a wife and two kids, and it doesn't bother him that he may never see them again, or maybe they won't have their father to grow up. He doesn't care.
Friend, you're trying to put rationality into a man that just committed mass shootings. We can't do that.
Exactly. Exactly.
No, you can't. There's no rationale. That's scary. I mean, I'm sure his kids are not. Kids think he's wonderful. If they're, he's been radicalized, I'm sure they don't care. Or maybe they do care. Maybe the wife cares. Who knows? So before we end, I want to thank everyone, but I want to remind everyone that on December 11th at 10, we're going to be talking to Doug about A-List. And on the 12th, Mike and I are going to get into school safety, whether there should be the murder that took place in the Bronx was in my old school. 67 on Mohegan Avenue. Yeah, that hurt. And when I heard the mayor say, is this what we're coming to? Yeah, you need metal detectors, so we're going to talk about that. I had an incident when I was the dean where my principal was a chicken. She was afraid of the kids. And it seemed that it was election day, and one of the boys in the fifth grade decided to take the gun from the guy that was the cop that was watching everything on election day, and he grabbed the gun. And they sent me down to go get it. From him. Yeah, missed 5 feet, nothing. And I looked at him and I said to the cop, big huge guy, I go, how did that happen? How could you lose your, and the boy, I won't say his name, was pointing, and I said, just hand it to me, turn it around, so I get the barrel of the gun, the back, and he handed it to me because he was like going to kill him. He says, you're going to kill me. I said, no, I'm not going to kill you, but what I am going to do is suspend you for a week, and you're in serious trouble, and you're going to have a police report. And I said to the officer, I said, basically, you should arrest him, and he needs to learn his lesson. And he just said to me, well, maybe he'll write a composition. I said, maybe you need to get tougher. I'm going, really? Seriously? I thought you had to see the cutting. The color went out of my face. I'm going, like, she asked, and she put me in this spot. I'm like, thank, and I said to the guy, is the safety on? Is the gun loaded? I don't want to know. So, these things could really happen. You never know. And, Mike, when are you writing the next book? I'm ready.
You know, Fran, I keep going back and forth. I got so many things going. I've really overextended myself, and probably not until I start shedding some things off of my plate. You know, and the show, I love it, but it's the show, as you know, keeps me busier than I expected.
And Fran, this is Larry. Put me down.
I love the show. I watch it. I watch some of your
show. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't hear your question.
Do you like doing the show Crimes and Victims? Are you going to continue doing it?
Crimes and Times, I absolutely love it. And if I may, tonight we're going to be talking about Manafort and Papadopoulos. We have on a well-known national security law expert, Mark Zaid, who's on CNN and MSNBC regularly, and he's taking time to come on tonight. And since we talked about Sammy the Bull Gravano, in January we're going to have on the case agent who successfully prosecuted John Gotti. The FBI agent who brought that case on, and we talk about that.
Where can I find your show?
If you go to Michael Tabman, T-A-B-M-A-N, go to my Facebook page, and then there's always a link to the Crimes and Times. It'll be on tonight, 8 p.m. Central, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll have a link there, to the page, and it'll just come on. It's live. It's live. Which means,
if you don't
sometimes
get it, email me because I get it. I get the link every morning. Right. That's how I know what you did. And on the 19th, Bruce and I are going to talk about Beneath the Depths. That was really fantastic. And Larry's book is coming out March 1st, right?
Yeah, so put me down sometime the first week in March.
Okay, so you have to let me know when you want to do the interview. Are you doing a tour with Partners in Crime for this one, or are you doing this by yourself?
Yes, of course.
I have to know.
I'm working with Partners in Crime. I've already been talking to Cheryl, of course. They're the best.
Well, then... I know they're the best. They're doing my tour for Daughter's Promise, and they really are fantastic.
Yeah.
Cheryl's great, and I'm sure she's going to contact me because they don't let me live. Every single day I get, like, Frank, could you read this? Frank, could you read this? I know that Catherine Hall Page just wrote A Body in a Casket, and I floored them. I said, I read it already. Just tell me when I'm reposting my review. I've got a ton of books inside. But if you guys want to know what to read for Christmas, Hanukkah, and Kwanzaa, you want to buy A-List. You want to buy a few copies of Bad Intent because it's really good. And Beneath, you want to buy both of Bruce's books, Among the Shadows and Beneath the Depths. And my review will come out this afternoon. I hope I did a good job. And
thank you,
thank you everybody so much. DP,
thank you.
I can't wait to talk to you on the 11th.
Thank you. It's very
thank you so much.
Very
have a great
you,
day.
It's a very
and
panel.
I think I'm going to stick to writing horror and fiction and nonfiction. I don't think I was made for this unless somebody wants to give me a written list of what to do. I'm not gonna do that. You guys are,
hey, thank
are too
you guys.
Good.
I really enjoyed being on with you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good talking with you guys.
All right. Yeah. Talk to everybody.
Thank
later.
You so much.
Thanks,
everybody,
Ram.
Have a nice day, and bye.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye, everyone.